I didn't even realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a back seat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
I'm here with SpinQuest, where you can play and win from the comfort of your own home with hundreds of slot games and all of the table games you love with real cash prizes. Right now, $30 coin packs are on sale for $10 for new users. It's all at SpinQuest.com. That's SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Information discussed in this podcast may be sensitive in nature to some listeners. Listener discretion is advised. Many missing person cases are considered controversial for various reasons. There are often multiple sides to every situation. I've encountered this firsthand as I have spoken to different families of the missing throughout the years. There's always more than one opinion. There's more than one theory, and many times what one side of the family knows about a person is not what the other side knows. And this brings in controversy. However, there are some cases that are more controversial than others. Over the years of reporting and researching on these missing person cases, I can easily identify a few very controversial missing person cases that stand out above the rest. And for what it's worth, I don't mind dealing with the controversy if it's what I need to do for these cases to get more exposure. Let's keep sharing disappearances and help get them solved. If there is one question and one question only that we all need to be asking about these cases, about these people, regardless of what side you are on, is where are they? Hello, and welcome to a bonus episode of the Where Are They podcast. I often get asked what I personally think of the cases I cover, which ones I remember the most, which ones are the most heartbreaking, which do I feel are the most baffling. Today, let's take a look at three cases I covered that I would easily classify as some of the most controversial. Ray Gricar. The case of Ray Gricar is one I've always thought about, a Pennsylvania district attorney who vanished under very strange circumstances. Many signs point to a self-harm situation, but many signs point to something nefarious. And then there was the fact that he was a district attorney involved in many other controversial cases that put him in the spotlight, and not always in a positive light. Ray Gricar had an enviable legal career throughout the 80s and 90s, but his legal career was second in his life next to his daughter, Laura. Ray was a doting dad and even spent Laura's younger years as a stay-at-home dad. Ray grew up in Cleveland, Ohio, and was a big Cleveland sports fan. When his wife took a job at Penn State University, the family moved to Pennsylvania. In 1985, Ray began his career as a district attorney in Center County, Pennsylvania. He took on some of the county's most serious criminals. However, in 1998, Ray's decision to not prosecute Jerry Sandusky, one of Penn State's football coaches, for sexual assault against minors, caused a rift in Ray's supporters. Many were not happy about his decision. In 2005, Ray announced that he would not run for re-election that year and intended to retire. He was looking forward to relaxing, traveling, and visiting his daughter, who now lived on the West Coast. On April 15th, Ray woke up and spontaneously decided to take the day off work. His girlfriend at the time, Patty Fornicola, told him to go enjoy the day, and she herself headed into her work that morning. At 11:30 a.m., Ray called Patty to tell her that he was taking a drive to visit some antique shops and that he wouldn't be home to let the dog out that afternoon. Patty said no problem, she would go right home after work, and that's exactly what she did. By late evening, however, Ray still wasn't home and he wasn't answering his phone. Patty reported Ray as missing, and authorities started looking for Ray immediately. They considered their district attorney as one of their own in law enforcement. Ray's car would be found in an antique mall parking lot in Lewisburg, Pennsylvania. In his car were cigarette butts, despite the fact that Ray himself did not smoke. Ray's county-issued laptop was also missing. Searches for Ray turned up very few clues. That is, until the summer arrived and Ray's laptop was found under a bridge at the Susquehanna River. The hard drive had been completely removed. In October, the hard drive was found, totally destroyed, also found on the banks of the river. There were a few main theories. Number one, Ray harmed himself and was likely near or in the river where his laptop was found and near where his car was found. Ray's brother had previously done the same thing, sadly ending his own life at a river in Ohio. Did Ray follow in his footsteps? The questionable aspect of this was that Ray was just months away from retirement and was excitedly looking forward to that part of his life. He didn't seem, at least to anyone else that knew him, to be unhappy in any way. Number two, Ray met with foul play. Did Ray make enemies in his job as a district attorney? Absolutely. One of the main thoughts within this theory was Ray's involvement in the Jerry Sandusky case. 1998 was one of Ray's toughest years of his career. He was presented with a case against Jerry Sandusky, a football coach at Penn State. This case was extremely public, as Sandusky was very well known in the area, and the accusations were extremely serious. He was being accused of sexual assault crimes against minors. Locals were furious and enraged, and many wanted Sandusky arrested and tried for these crimes. But Ray refused to press charges, citing a lack of evidence. Many had come to wonder if there was more to this, and Ray would suffer a lot of backlash. Did this have anything to do with his disappearance? Theory number three, Ray ran away to start a new life somewhere. This is tough for his family to imagine, especially his daughter. But there were several possible sightings of Ray that would come in over the years, including one in Texas that was never able to be ruled out or confirmed, with even some of his family believing that that photo might be of Ray. But was this indeed Ray? And if so, why was he in Texas? Many people have strong theories on Ray's case, especially the locals in Pennsylvania. Many believe his disappearance is linked to the Jerry Sandusky case. Many believe he just took off, fearing he was going to get in trouble for something, perhaps something to do with the laptop that was destroyed. And still, some believe that he most likely committed suicide at the river. What do you think happened to Ray Gricar? Michelle Harris. Michelle Ann Taylor met the well-known businessman Cal Harris in the early 1980s. Michelle even spent some time working for their family-owned car dealerships before she and Cal wed in 1990. They had three children together before their marriage would become strained. Michelle would be pregnant with their fourth child when their marriage would completely crumble. By early 2001, divorce proceedings had begun. Cal was not happy about the divorce, and he tried to convince Michelle to reconsider. Michelle had made up her mind, however. The morning of September 11th, 2001, the world changed forever. Michelle spent the morning at her home in Spencer, New York, which she still shared with her soon-to-be ex-husband and their four children. Michelle left for work that afternoon for her job at Lefty's Restaurant. After work, she had a couple of drinks with friends and then visited her boyfriend, Brian, whom she had been seeing in the next town over. Michelle left his house just after 11 o'clock p.m., telling him that she was heading home. It had been a long day, and she was emotional over the day's tragedies. The next morning, Cal woke up and realized Michelle hadn't come home the night before. He called their nanny and their housekeeper to see if she could come over that morning and help get the kids off to school, and the nanny said she'd be there as soon as possible. When she arrived at the Harris estate, she found Michelle's gold minivan parked at the end of the driveway, but no sign of Michelle. She drove up to the house and told Cal that Michelle's minivan was at the end of the drive, and Cal immediately called authorities. Michelle had disappeared. The search for Michelle was complicated. Cal believed that she likely took off with a boyfriend, but he was also said to be acting quite strangely. Others thought he had to be involved. Not only was his behavior odd, but he was angry about the divorce, and he was having to pay Michelle a large sum of money. A week after Michelle disappeared, Cal also started selling off some of her personal belongings, which enraged some of Michelle's family and friends. In 2005, Cal Harris was officially charged with Michelle's murder. She was still missing, but prosecutors felt they had enough circumstantial evidence for a conviction. They believed that Cal and Michelle had a fight, something that wasn't uncommon in their relationship, and that Cal had murdered her and then disposed of her body. One of the rumored ways he disposed of her was by putting her in a vehicle that was destined for the scrapyard to be crushed and demolished. Or there was a theory that she might be in Empire Lake, a lake on the Harris property. Searches there, however, turned up no clues. In 2007, the murder charge was thrown out by the judge due to some technicalities. Right away, prosecutors filed murder charges against Cal for a second time. In June of 2007, Cal was convicted of Michelle's murder. Cal was emotional and sobbed. And during all of this, Michelle and Cal's four children stood by their father. In November of 2007, however, a judge overturned that conviction and ordered a new trial. This was in part due to a new witness that came forward right after Cal's conviction. This new witness, who claims to have seen an article in the paper about Cal being convicted of Michelle's murder, decided to come forward claiming to have seen Michelle the night she vanished on the side of the road talking to a man in a pickup truck. Another trial would commence, and once again, in August of 2009, Cal Harris was convicted of Michelle's murder and sentenced to 25 years to life. As if this story couldn't get any crazier, unbelievably, in October of 2012, after 3 years in prison, Cal's conviction was once again overturned. And again, prosecutors filed new charges and proceeded to try him for murder. Cal and his defense team would now implicate a man working in the area who would have drinks with Michelle at the restaurant where she worked. This man was from Texas, and this is the man the defense believes was seen with Michelle by that pickup truck in the late night, early morning hours of September 12th. That trial ended in a mistrial. In the spring of 2016, Cal decided on a bench trial instead of a jury trial and was finally acquitted of Michelle's murder. He cannot be tried again for her murder due to double jeopardy laws in the United States. Cal and Michelle's children have stood by their father and believe in his innocence. They said they lost many years with him when he was incarcerated, but they know he did not kill their mother. Did Cal's money and local connections help him get away with murder, or has he been unfairly targeted? Locals and those who knew the couple well are split. Michelle Harris remains a missing person. Benny Battle. Benny Battle from Dixie County, Florida, is another controversial case from a small town. Half the town sees a corrupt cover-up, and the other half believes nothing of the sort. Benny has now been missing since December of 2019. Benny Battle grew up in the small town of Yulee, Florida, just miles from the Georgia border. Benny was always close to his family, and that would continue on into his adult years. Benny eventually moved to the west coast of Florida to a small town known as Old Town, located in Dixie County. Benny would enjoy spending time with his daughter, he would enjoy fishing, and he enjoyed working out. Benny did have some trouble with drugs, but as of 2018, he seemed to be doing much better. Benny Battle was last known to be at a home in Old Town, Florida on December 10th, 2019. His niece went to the home that evening to see Benny, but found a bunch of other people there instead. She said she felt uncomfortable as they were acting strange, and she decided to leave. The next day, December 11th, 2019, a friend showed up at the home to pick Benny up for his court date for a pending case from the year before, but Benny was not there. Benny had been working hard to get this case settled, and it was almost there. It simply did not make sense that he wouldn't show up. Benny has not been seen or heard from since. Authorities would issue a warrant for his arrest due to his failure to show up in court. This, along with his history of drugs and legal trouble, led law enforcement to believe that Benny was just on the run. Their efforts to find him were minimal. Yet others in this small town began to talk. They began to talk about a cover-up in which Benny had been murdered. When law enforcement was found discussing the case at a local bar one evening, complete with giving up names of potential witnesses and interviews they had conducted, the town began to get the feeling of a conspiracy, a cover-up, or overall just total distrust of the authorities in this case. No one wanted to talk now. No one wanted to come forward. Was law enforcement involved? Was this part of the good old boys club? Searches were few and far between, and not much was found to point anyone to Benny's whereabouts. His family is certain he wouldn't stay gone for this long, and they do believe that he was murdered. Is there a cover-up in Dixie County, Florida? Where is Benny Battle? This is just three of hundreds of cases I covered, but three that have some very controversial elements. There are more, and I will be back with a part two very soon. Thank you so much for being here and for supporting our show. Your support is what helps keep us going, and we appreciate it so much. We will be back again very soon with another Unsolved Missing Person episode, and until then, stay safe and hug your loved ones. Hello, and welcome to a bonus episode of the Where Are They podcast. This is part two of our most controversial cases. Now let's get right into part two of our most controversial cases. Detrez Green. This case is bizarre, and I'm not sure personally what to make of it, but there is a fair amount of controversy in Detrez's case. Tornadoes hit southern Georgia with a vengeance the weekend of January 21st, 2017. Not just one or two, but several devastating storms ripped through small towns, changing the landscape forever. On January 22nd, 2017, one of these fierce storms tore through Albany, Georgia, and struck a mobile home park. This happened around 3 o'clock p.m. Around 8:30 p.m., local authorities received a 911 call of a young boy who had gone missing during this storm. Two-year-old Detrez Green lived with his parents and siblings in one of those mobile homes at Piney Woods Estates, right where the tornado had blasted through hours earlier. Immediately, law enforcement officers converged on the scene to search for the toddler. Detrez's mother, Adesia Rainey, told authorities that she had been holding on to Detrez, but right as the tornado was striking their home, the boy got out of her arms and went towards the kitchen. The kitchen was an area of the home that had been demolished by a fallen tree from the storm. But searches uncovered no sign of the young boy, and investigators were becoming frustrated and confused. The family couldn't provide them with a photo of the young boy, stating that they just didn't have one. Extended family members and neighbors also claimed to have never seen this child. As more and more family and friends came forward to state that they had never met this child, speculation on his existence ran rampant. Is it possible that they just weren't close to the family and they had just not met the child? Or was something else at play here? Was this young toddler a victim of a vicious and terrible storm? A tornado with wind speeds up to 155 miles an hour? A tornado that had ransacked the entire area, picking up cars and even homes. If this storm could pick up a car, certainly it could have picked up a small two-year-old boy. But as investigators and searchers spent days and days looking for the boy, they would learn some troubling details. Detrez Green was born October 28, 2014, to mom Adesia Rainey and dad Kevion Green. Adesia and Kevion had a troubled relationship. In 2014, the couple was living in Ashburn, Georgia, with their children. There was an incident one day that would bring the police, including SWAT teams, out to their home. There was a standoff, and allegedly, Kevion was keeping Adesia and the children in the home. There isn't much information about this particular incident, but Kevion was arrested. He would later be released, however, and charges against him would be dropped. Kevion and Adesia remained together, but the Department of Children's Services would get involved with the two children. Detrez would allegedly be born later that same year. Kevion and Adesia had some more issues in Ashburn, but would eventually move to the Piney Wood Mobile Home Park. In January of 2017, tornadoes hit southern Georgia with a vengeance. This was a particularly volatile month for tornadoes in Georgia that year. Sunday, January 22nd, 2017, was a day that residents of Albany, Georgia would never forget. Adesia Rainey and Kevion Green were at home that day with their three young children, and at first, said they weren't too concerned about the storm. They spent the day watching television together and cooking, up until 3:15 p.m., that is. The wind started pulling their trailer home apart, and Adesia knew it was serious. She grabbed her two-year-old son, Detrez, tried to hang on to him, but he pulled away from her and ran toward the kitchen area just as a large tree fell on the home. As I had mentioned, these storms were record-breaking, and this particular tornado would be rated an F3 and would see winds up to 155 miles per hour. It was extreme chaos after the tornado hit. The town would experience damage like never seen before. People were running around looking for family, friends, and neighbors Cars were left overturned, furniture and debris littered the area, and trees were ripped right out of the ground. Emergency crews were on scene almost immediately. Kevion and Adeja went out of their mobile home checking on others. A few hours later, around 8:30 p.m., Adeja called to report Detrez missing. The dispatcher asked Adeja if she had been searching for Detrez on her own, and she responded, a little. The dispatcher asked if they had notified emergency crews, the ones who were on the scene at the mobile home park, and she said that while she had spoken to some of the personnel, as had Kevion, they had not told them about Detrez. Searches began for the little boy, but those searches turned up no sign of Detrez. Detrez was never found. Since there were no photos and no family members or friends to even confirm that the young boy existed, many people began to have their doubts. 7 years later, we have about as much information as we did that day Detrez vanished, and it is still a controversial mystery in Georgia. Did something happen to Detrez Green during those awful tornadoes? Or are Adeja and Kevion taking advantage of the timing of the tornado? But if they are, why? There are three main possibilities here. Number one, something did happen to Detrez during that tornado. But why did it seem like Adeja and Kevion had a lack of interest in finding their son? Number two, something happened to Detrez before the tornado, and the tornado became the cover-up story. Or number three, Detrez never existed. What do you think? Jennifer Cahill Shadle. Jennifer Cahill Shadle was in the middle of a terrible divorce in 2014. It was almost over, but it had been an extremely hard time for Jennifer. She didn't initially want this divorce, and her biggest struggle was being away from her kids for any length of time. In fact, it was such a rough time for Jennifer that in November of 2013, she moved away from her home in State College, Pennsylvania, to move in and live with her mother in Orwigsburg, Pennsylvania. Her mother had said that she needed to get out. The situation at home was dire and not good for Jennifer. But by April of 2014, she could no longer stand being so far away from her children. Her mom drove her back to State College. Her divorce would be final soon, that was the hope anyway, and the order for spousal support for Jennifer was around $5,000 a month. Certainly, her husband, Sean, wasn't happy about it, but it seemed that everybody wanted the divorce over with. While Jennifer waited, funds were low, and she didn't have a place of her own to live. She was residing temporarily in a motel in State College. On May 15th, 2014, Jennifer went to Walmart, a tanning salon, and possibly a Mexican restaurant. Jennifer was never seen or heard from again. Now, Jennifer, at 48 years old, didn't need to answer to anyone. Jennifer was also going through a stressful time. Maybe she just needed to get away for a while. Maybe she needed to escape. When police asked Sean where they thought Jennifer might have gone, he shrugged and said, quote, probably some rehab somewhere, end quote. Jennifer's family said that, yes, she had previous struggles with alcohol, but there's no way she would go to rehab without telling them. Jennifer spoke to her mom daily and her daughters. Why wouldn't she just tell them if she were going to go back to a rehab center? If she had been struggling with alcohol, why wouldn't she just tell them and she were planning on going back to rehab? Law enforcement refused to look into it any further, as Jennifer is an adult. Plus, Sean, being very well known and well connected within the community, told police that Jennifer likely just left on her own, either to rehab or maybe she just wanted to leave. Police knew Sean well enough to take him at his word. Immediately, Jennifer's family began calling investigators and using social media to find her, and the battles would begin. Many, many people stood up for Sean. Many, many people did not. Even Sean's sister came forward to say that she thought Sean knew more than he was saying, and that he wasn't quite the stand-up citizen that many people thought he was. But conflicting stories were coming in from every angle, from all friends and family, in every direction. Investigators were pressured to take another look at Jennifer's case, and eventually surveillance footage from the Walmart on North Atherton Street in Ferguson State College was analyzed, and Jennifer is seen leaving Walmart at 4:51 p.m. by herself on May 15th. Police did decide to go ahead and put out a missing person alert, but she isn't yet officially entered as a missing person in the database. Investigators weren't quite ready to go that far yet. More people started coming forward with claims that Sean was abusive, and of course, his motive for making his wife disappear, possibly that $5,000 a month in spousal support he was so close to having to pay. Based on the timing of it all, it certainly doesn't look good. During all of this time, Sean and Jennifer's children were living with their dad, and they fully believed in his innocence and supported him. Investigators did reluctantly bring Sean in for questioning, and they did give him a lie detector test, to which they ruled inconclusive. They also took search dogs, trained in cadaver and human remain detection, to search Sean's home and property, but again, nothing was found. 1 year after Jennifer disappeared, the family fought to get the FBI involved. They felt the FBI could offer some different resources and might bring a fresh perspective to the case. They might also be a little bit less biased than the local police force. However, in order for the FBI to come in on a case, the local police has to invite them. And they refused. During the investigation, Sean received both accusations for being involved in Jennifer's disappearance from some, and he received unwavering support from others. Sean is still a well-known and active community member. And Jennifer and Sean's daughter has now entered politics in the state of Pennsylvania. She stands by her father's innocence. It certainly becomes tricky when a local businessman and politician are closely involved in a missing person case. What do you think about the case of Jennifer Cahill Shadle? What other missing person cases come to mind as being wildly controversial? Thank you so much for being here and supporting our show. Your support is truly what keeps us going. We will be back again very soon with another Unsolved Missing Persons episode. And until then, stay safe and hug your loved ones.
SpinQuest Social Casino. The new year may be coming to an end, but the excitement never does on SpinQuest.com. With live blackjack, craps, and so many slots, and jackpots that don't need a countdown. Your New Year's resolution is more fun on SpinQuest.com. New year and new players right now get $30 coin packs for just $10.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.